keep it free. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Buttar. I just want to take a moment to introduce this next audio. It happens to be one of my more favorite pieces as far as pieces that I've been interviewed for. It actually involves the field of cancer, but it's much more than an interview about cancer. The reason I say that is that it took me a number of years, and some of you may have already heard the story, so I apologize if this is redundant, but it took me many years to realize that the same defining factors between success and failure, that the same components that define success versus failure in cancer are actually the same determining factors that define success versus failure in all chronic disease. And because I'm a little slow, it took me a little bit more time to realize that it's those same defining factors that dictate the difference between success and failure, not only in all chronic disease, but in all facets of life, including personal, social, financial, spiritual, emotional issues. All of them are actually dictated by the same factors that define success versus failure as in a cancer patient. So when I was asked to do this interview, and during the interview, there were certain things that came up that may not have been necessarily pertinent to the field of cancer exclusively, and it took on a different energy. So during the interview process, it was interesting that there were certain components of the interview that tended to go off track, but it all came out, as far as I'm concerned, to be one of the better interviews that I've done because it dealt with an issue that is very important to everyone, and I hope that everybody enjoys this audio as much as I enjoyed being interviewed for it. Now let me say a few words about cancer. Every 21.8 seconds, someone in the United States is hearing their doctor say, "I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but you have cancer." Now, these dreaded words are being heard by literally millions of people worldwide. According to the numbers from the American Cancer Society, in 2007 alone, 1,444,920 people heard those words just in the United States. In Canada, another 1,248,899 people heard those same exact words. And throughout the world, millions, literally millions more, will hear those same words. Now, these numbers only represent the patients themselves. Tens of millions more will have their lives torn into shreds because a person who these words were said to will be their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, their wife, their husband, their son or their daughter, their neighbor or their work associate. Hopefully, you're not like the average person asking, "What does this have to do with me?" In the United States, one out of every two men and one out of every three women will experience hearing those words sometime in their life. Look around you. Every time you're shopping, you're pumping gas, or even you're at your house with your friends, one out of every two or three of you will hear those same words sometime in your life. Now, how does it feel to know that if you're a man, that every time you talk to another man, that either you or they will have cancer one day? And by the way, we're just talking about cancer right now. We're not even discussing any of the other major diseases. The question is, can any of this be prevented? Can you do something to prevent yourself from becoming one out of the two men or one out of three women who's going to get cancer? Is that even possible? The answer is there, but it'll be determined by what you choose to do in your life. This audio that you're about to hear, my hope is that it will give you a lot of that information and point you in the right direction.
Hi, folks. This is Dave Bernstein, and welcome to Story of Survival. Now, today we're speaking with Dr. Rashid Buttar from North Carolina, and he'll be telling us about his own personal experience with his patients' stories of survival, how they not only survived cancer, but thrived in its aftermath. So without further ado, let's go ahead and welcome Dr. Buttar. Dr. Buttar, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I'd like you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background and bio.
Well, I am a physician who has been practicing now for 19 years. And I've been blessed that I've been able to take care of patients from 34 different countries. And we've gotten a lot of accolades for our accomplishments in medicine. And my background is in general surgery. That's what I did, general surgery and trauma medicine. But for whatever reason, there's a whole story, and I know we don't have time to go into it, but I was compelled to start looking at cancer. And cancer, I've never had any personal history or, you know, having anybody personally close to me die from cancer or anything like that. I don't have any kind of exotic story. It was just that it's been the one thing in my career as a doctor that I've had some very strong feelings towards for whatever reason. And I know when I was an intern, when I was a resident, when I was a medical student, there were experiences that I had with patients and cancer that I just did not want to, I knew that I didn't want to deal with that type of a thing. I didn't want to deal with oncology. I didn't want to do internal medicine. And my reason for wanting to go into surgery was to be able to see the tumor, be able to cut it out, look at it, spit on it, throw it in the ground, stomp on it, and be done with it. But after a number of years of doing that while in training, I realized that that's not the answer, because many of these patients said we would take the tumors out and we'd throw it in the ground, stomp on it, and think everything was fine and have no evidence of it being in the body anymore. 6 months later, a year later, it's been recurred. And so there's been a personal interest. Why it started, how it started, I can't tell you, but we have made our name in the medical realm in cancer and in autism. Those are the two areas that we're known in.
I know you opened the Advanced Medicine and Clinical Research in 1996, and you've got a mission statement that I want to read. It's not only to extend your patients' lives, but to improve the quality of that extended life. Now, what does that mean to you? I mean, what are some of the things that you've seen that people have been able to accomplish after being at your clinic?
Well, the philosophy that we have in a nutshell is one, detoxification, and two, immune modulation. And in cancer specifically, there's five steps that we go through. And if you do those five steps, which is essentially physiological optimization, detoxification is the second one, immune modulation is the third one, target acquisition is the fourth one, and then maintenance. These five steps, if we can do that, which all are specifics that go through those first two things that I said, immune modulation and detoxification, if you can do that, not only are you going to extend life, but you're going to improve the quality of that extended life. And in all areas of chronic disease, not just in cancer, but in anything that you're dealing with. And that actually, that statement is a slogan that we came up with a long time ago. Our mission statement, we have a very specific mission statement that is on the walls of our clinic, which is to make the change the world is waiting for. And by extending life, not only the length of the life, but the quality of that extended life, we believe that we are making the change the world's waiting for.
Now, have patients already been diagnosed by the time they get to you, or do you assist in diagnosis as well?
Absolutely not. We do not diagnose cancer. We are not in the business of diagnosing cancer. In fact, if somebody comes to us primarily with the concern that they may have cancer, we'll do our stuff, but we send them to a standard conventional oncologist and let them make their diagnosis, and then they can come back to us if that's what they choose. And there's a number of reasons for that. I believe that many times, in fact, one of the most prominent people in the field of alternative medicine, Burton Goldberg, and I've been given the liberty of using his name, he actually is the guy who put out Alternative Medicine, the Guide to Alternative Medicine, the big phone book-looking silver book you've probably seen. Burton himself was diagnosed with cancer, and he went to Germany for treatment, but the German doctor he went to see, plus two other people, doctors that were close to him, they all said the same thing. They said, before you do anything, go talk to Buttar. So he came to North Carolina, and he became my seventh person with a diagnosis of cancer who did not have cancer. Mm-hmm. And so this opens up another can of worms. Many times people are diagnosed with cancer that didn't really have cancer, and they go through the treatment, and then they end up dying from the chemotherapy. And, you know, the statistics are very clear. In fact, 42 to 46% of the patients that die of cancer die of malnutrition. And then the remaining 54% or so of the patients, you know, what's the cause of death? Some people would say it's the treatment, the chemo and the radiation. So how many people actually die of cancer? Cancer is a wasting away type of disease. So when people truly just die of cancer, if they've never had any type of treatment, they're not going to die from the cancer itself. They usually die from renal failure, liver failure. They die from a common cold, a pneumonia, or something like that, because the cancer basically just eats away at their body. So when we're talking about what caused the person to actually die, what is the actual cause of death in cancer patients, we have to start looking at not only the nutritional aspect and all these other components that we're dealing with, and these components of nutrition versus some of these side effects of the treatments versus the body being wasting away. These are the issues that we have to look at. When we start talking about who made the diagnosis, what was their motivation when they made the diagnosis? Cancer is a very, very big business, so we don't make the diagnosis of cancer at all. In fact, the first probably dozen patients or so that we had success with cancer, when they went back to their oncologist said, well, you know, we're not really sure if you had cancer. And that was a very frustrating thing. So now I will not even see a person. We won't even start the treatments until we have an independent third-party pathology report that confirms the patient had cancer. And then once we've got that, then we will go ahead and start treating them. But that way I've got something tangible that says, hey, this person has cancer, and this is what the path report showed. Otherwise, the results come back and say, well, we're not even sure this person really had cancer, when we know that they had cancer, or they're being treated for cancer when they didn't have cancer, as I used the example with Burton. So that's the reason, and that's a very long answer to your question, but that's the reason that we don't diagnose cancer. We usually will only see a person once they've been diagnosed with cancer, but if somebody does come to us and they're concerned about that, we'll do our own workup, tell them what we see, but tell them that they need to go see a conventional oncologist before we start any kind of treatment, and we need to have that pathology report so that we have something definitive to rely upon.
No, it absolutely sounds like a responsible thing to do here. Now, when people get to your clinic, does that education, the education that we just discussed, are you educating them as well as to what they should have already in hand by the time they get to you?
That's a great question. In fact, today was a perfect example of somebody that came all the way from Wisconsin with cancer, and they did not bring any of their medical records, so I just had a meeting with my head of my clinical staff to tell them that make sure that new patients know to bring their records, because we didn't have any records for this gentleman. But we do try to educate people on what they need to bring with them, but we also educate people before they ever make the decision to come here. My goal is not that the patient comes here. I don't care where the patient goes. I just want them to be aware of what the real issues are. And what the real issues are, what causes cancer. People say, well, we don't know really what causes cancer, and you know, that's what the big picture is out there, that we really don't know what causes cancer, and we'll war against cancer, we're going to stamp it out with this chemo and this radiation and the surgery and blah, blah, blah. Well, the cause of cancer is very, very clear. You'd have to be an absolute imbecile not to know what the cause of cancer is. It's toxicity. Toxicity causes a change in the internal environment of the body, and the body then compensates, trying to survive against it. It's a nutritional depletion. The body's run down. It's not getting what it needs, and then it's laden with all these toxic substances, and the body, in order to try to survive, goes into this rapid state of proliferation. Now, I'm going to come back and explain a little bit more in detail and give you an analogy that will hopefully make it clearer, but to answer your original question, the goal is to educate the individual worldwide, to make the people aware, to allow people to become empowered with knowledge, because with knowledge comes power, so they understand that what they're experiencing when they get cancer, or one of their loved ones get cancer, they understand what's going on, what's truly going on, and then it gives them the options of what they can do. And when I say options, I'm not talking about coming to us, because the options are, which way do they really want to go? Which way do they want to proceed? And there are many doctors that can help patients using maybe different methods than we're using, but with the same type of philosophy. The goal is to educate and empower the masses that what's happening to the field of chronic disease, specifically cancer and heart disease, the way we're going about it. In fact, if you look at all chronic disease, the way we're going about it with chronic disease, we are regressing. We're becoming more and more primitive. In fact, I believe that right now in history, history will remember us as being one of the most primitive periods in the evolution of medicine and the healing arts, because we're trying to cover up symptoms. It's like cancer is kind of like a dashboard on a car that starts blinking with a red light, and that red light tells us something, and in many cases that red light is warning us that damage has already started and it's going to continue to worsen unless something's done about it. And our modern, conventional, traditional method of treating that red light, that cancer, that warning of pain or whatever you want to call it, whatever the difficulty the person's experiencing, whatever the symptom is to go in and take the fuse out. Rather than fixing the problem, looking at the engine, trying to figure out what's causing that light to flash and taking care of the problem at its source, our solution in modern medicine is to take the fuse out so there's no more blinking light. And as soon as there's no more blinking light, the illusion is that the problem has been covered. It's taken care of. It's been solved. And so now you don't see a blinking light. Everything's fine until the engine blows. And so that's the problem. We have to start looking at the source of the problem. And the source of cancer, where did it all start? It started from a level of toxicity on board a physiology that didn't have sufficient nutrient basis to protect itself.
You know, that dashboard analogy was amazing. In fact, to our listeners out there, you might want to rewind this and listen to that again. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a car and the light comes on and you ignore the light and you ignore the light and then you wonder why something's not going right there.
Here's a little component to this too. I want you to maybe think about this part, because this really is a frustration for me as a physician and seeing how doctors deal with patients. If you were to take your car with that flashing light to a mechanic, and the mechanic told you that the way that we're going to deal with this is we're going to take the fuse out, and it takes the fuse out and the flat light is not flashing, what would you say to that mechanic? What would your response be to that mechanic? How would you respond to that?
I might have an attitude about it. I can promise you that. I mean, sometimes you think that you know more than the mechanic does.
You know that yourself, as little as you may know about car engines, that the solution is not to take the light that's flashing out as a warning out, but rather to look at the engine and figure out what the problem is. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if your doctor is going to go in there and take that flashing warning out and not look at the engine and not try to figure out what the problem is, that's the same thing as them, as a mechanic, ignoring the problem with the engine and trying to take the fuse out. When a doctor gives you a drug and says, well, I'm not sure what's going on here, try this drug. You know, do you know what the most number one prescribed medication in the entire I think in the entire Northern Hemisphere, possibly in the world, is. Do you know what the drug is? Prozac. It is the most widely prescribed drug. I know in the United States, and I think it's North America, it may be in the entire world, the most prescribed drug. Why is that? Because when patients come to the doctor and they're not feeling well, they're not feeling healthy, their systems aren't working right, and the doctor does all the blood work and there's nothing wrong and chemistry-wise it's fine and the labs are fine, they say, well, I think it's in your, you know, I think you're depressed. Here, take this medicine. Well, of course the person's depressed if they're not feeling well, and the blood work won't show if their bodies are toxic with certain types of substances and if their systems aren't working right. So you look at the blood work doesn't show anything. They say, okay, you know, you're depressed. Yes, of course they're depressed, but the depression was caused by a physiological imbalance. I've had patients that have come to me that were told by multiple doctors that they should be on antidepressants, and then when the patient refused or the antidepressants didn't work and their symptoms got worse, the doctor said they were trying to put them on neuroleptics, on antipsychotic medication. This is how ridiculous our system has become.
Yeah, I totally agree. We briefly talked about attitude here. Now, based on your experience, how important is the role of attitude during and after cancer treatment? Do people need to go in with a great attitude right from the get-go?
We have a philosophy of treating based upon the seven toxicities, and I will give you, please remind me to give the resource that we have that's free for everybody that will help a lot of people regarding this. The fifth of those seven toxicities is called the emotional psychological toxicity, and I believe that that is the number one defining factor between success and failure of a patient that's suffering from cancer, whether they survive or they fail, meaning surviving meaning that they're continuing, and failing meaning that they transition to the next phase of whatever we believe, whether it's life, or, I mean, life after death, whatever a person believes, meaning that they're no longer on the planet, or what we would conventionally call death. So I don't believe in death. I believe that there's something that happens afterwards, and everybody else may have their own different belief. But if we're defining success as continuing on this planet and failure as moving on to the next realm, the number one defining factor there is that fifth toxicity, the emotional psychological component, and that has everything to do with attitude. Attitude, that's a huge component of that. Your mindset, what you believe, what you're willing to do, what the action that you take, where your attention is going, whether are you focusing on the cancer and giving it more energy, or are you focusing on you being better? What are you visualizing? What do you want in life? What has been the past history of your life, meaning the emotional psychological balance that you've had? Are the people that have created issues for you, or have you created issues of, you know, the issues of forgiveness and the issues of, there's so much emotional baggage that these people have. Every single person that I have treated that has cancer, there has been an amazing amount of emotional trauma that these people have experienced. In fact, it's amazing to me that anybody has dealt with that type of emotional trauma. And most of the people, when you're talking to them, they look like normal people, everyday people that, you know, you'd never think that they'd experienced or gone through such a horrifying experience sometime in their life. As an example, probably half a dozen patients that I've treated with cancer had lost a child early on in their life. So they, you know, they had a 3-year-old child that died, or they had a 4-year-old child, or they had a 16-year-old. They lost a loved one, their own offspring. And that's a tremendous emotional trauma for somebody to have to deal with. The issue of forgiveness, people having trauma that they've experienced, or when I say trauma, it doesn't mean necessarily physical trauma. In fact, generally it's not a physical trauma, but they've been scarred somehow emotionally, and they've held on to that baggage. So when somebody has something that eats away at them for weeks, for months, for years, eventually that contributes, that stress is contributing to that change in the physiology that allows for the propagation of oncogenesis or the cancer formation.
Now, we were talking about that mind-body connection here. I mean, do you honestly believe that cancer is not only a disease of the body, but indeed the mind can help accelerate its progress?
Well, I want you to understand one thing about me, and this is important, I think, for the people that are listening. I don't have opinions. Many, many times I have actually caused my own peer group to become alienated. They don't like what I've said because I have a tremendous ego, but when it comes to patient response, patient result, I have zero ego. So I don't express my opinions. I only state what I've seen on a consistent, repetitive basis, observation. So 5 years ago, 8 years ago, if you'd asked me this, I would have said, you know, maybe mind has something to do with it. 10 years ago, you'd ask me, I said, mind has nothing to do with it. Today, I will tell you, mind has everything to do with it. Why? Because in my observation, the more patients I've seen that component. So I've had two patients. Obviously, we haven't been successful with all our patients. Obviously, many of the patients that we get are already stage 4 cancer. They've already gone through chemo, radiation, and they're so far gone, there's very little that we can do. We have been successful at helping even some of those patients, but the longer a person waits and the more other problems that they have, when a person comes in and cancer isn't their primary issue anymore, their kidneys are failing, their lungs are failing, and their liver's failing, then it becomes even more difficult. But we've had two patients. So the reason I brought that up is because obviously we've had patients that have not... that we haven't been successful in keeping them alive. But some of these patients, of these two, we had two patients that ended up passing on, and the families, obviously most times when this happens, you assume that it's a cancer, but the families agreed to do an autopsy. Because for me personally, it didn't make sense why these patients had, because from our assessment, they had a complete clean bill of health. There was no cancer left in their body, yet they still died, and nobody knew why they died. The two families agreed to do autopsies because obviously there's a cost incurred and the families, you know, most families don't want to incur that cost. These two families agreed. They went ahead and got the autopsies. For both patients, no trace of cancer anywhere in their body. None. But they died exactly when their oncologist said they would die because that's what their mind believed. Now, I've had four patients, and we talk about this in our cancer DVD, the Cancer, the Untold Truth. We've had four patients that have gone through our treatment. Again, we believe they had no trace of cancer, and we did our assessments, no trace of cancer, doing fantastic, and yet still died, but they didn't die from the cancer. One died in a car wreck. One died from a heart attack. One died of a pulmonary emboli. Now, the point that I'm making there is that no matter how good the doctor is, no matter how good the will of the patient is, no matter how much the patient wants, the family of the patient wants them to live and do the right thing, and I tell all my patients that if God wants you, if your mission on this planet has been done, if you have completed what you were meant to when you came into this realm, there's nothing that anybody is going to be able to do to prevent that. However, my goal as a doctor is that if God wants you, that there must be a different exit strategy, that it won't be the cancer. That's the best that I can offer. And we have been able to see that person's life, they're energetic, they're whatever they were supposed to have done was done, and they went. But they didn't go from the cancer. And so I felt I could look at myself in the mirror and say that I did 110% what I was supposed to and what I could. And that's the best that I can offer anybody.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'm glad you shared that with us. Now, in the past, it's well known that chemotherapy not only destroys cancer cells, but also healthy cells. Now, you know, this has probably been a concern for a lot of patients. I had an opportunity to watch a video on your website, and I want you to talk about that if you feel comfortable doing so. The patient that you were working with went through some amazing results over a 3 to 4 year period, and she mentioned that her cells felt better than ever before. Would you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, that patient is actually it's kind of strange how things happen in life. She's actually an oncological nurse. She spent 40 years as an oncological nurse, a nurse that just dealt with cancer patients, and she ended up getting cancer herself. Well, that she was talking specifically about the response in her, as you may recall, I mentioned about our parameters that we use to assess improvement and, you know, whether a person has cancer or not. We look at certain types of immune response that the person's having. So we look at natural killer cells. We look at the lymphocyte subpopulation, which is the population of specific types of white blood cells. We look at apoptosis, which is programmed cellular suicide, and I can explain that for your viewers if you don't think they may know that. We go into a lot of detail on this on our DVDs, the Know Your Options medical series, that explains a lot of these things and how the blood work is assessed and what the numbers mean. But specifically, there's four things that we look at in that cell cycle. There's apoptosis, lymphocyte subpopulation, and natural killer cells. And without going into too much detail, these are basic direct or indirect measurements of the immune system. And conventional oncological approach, nobody looks at that. In fact, I've even had patients tell me that when they talk to their doctors about the natural killer cells, and the doctors looked at it and said, well, what role does that have to do with your cancer? And to me, that's just like being hit in the head with a baseball bat. When a doctor that specializes in cancer says, what role does your natural killer cells have in your cancer? Well, that's your immune system. You can't get cancer unless your immune system's damaged. So what she was talking about in those videos was that her parameters that we were monitoring, she started seeing those changes as we would do the testing. We would show it to her, and she starts seeing those changes herself. But did you notice when you were watching the video the difference in her face?
Absolutely. Her whole body was changing. I mean, her whole disposition.
Exactly, but the color of her face, and I mean, she looked like death warmed over when she first came in, I think it's 2003, 2004, but a year and a half later, she was given 6 months to live. And you understand that video, she had already had cancer, already had chemo, had already had radiation, and then had gone into remission, and then the cancer came back, and that's when she was given 6 months to live. So the first segment that you see in there, that's after the second bout of cancer hit her and there was nothing more left. So you can see how far she had gone. And then she was given 6 months to live at that point, and the second part of that video that you see is a year and a half after that initial point, after the point that she'd been given 6 months to live. So that physical transformation that you're talking about, that shows the system is being enhanced to a point where it's now able to live again. It is no longer in a mode of survival. It is actually now thriving. So those blood parameters that you asked me about that she mentions in the video is actually what you were able to see visually is manifestation of that change in that blood work. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, you bet. And we'll be sure to definitely give that website address to our listeners at the end of the interview. We want to make sure you have a chance to see that as well, too. We've had many of our listeners asking about alternative methods. And I want to ask you, what are your beliefs on meditation, stress management, self-hypnosis during and after treatment? What are your thoughts about that?
That goes into, again, the fifth toxicity and the seventh toxicity. And I will give you a website that will have videos that people can watch, 20 minutes each, 9 different videos. Doesn't cost anybody a single dime. The only thing we ask is that if you find it to be powerful, for you to pass it on to other people that may benefit from it. And that question is such an... I could talk about that for hours upon hours, probably days upon days. That fifth toxicity, the emotional psychological component, and the seventh toxicity, which is a spiritual component, all these seven toxicities must be addressed in order for a person to be able to reverse a chronic disease, especially cancer. And meditation has a component in there that helps with not only the fifth toxicity, that emotional, psychological, and the seventh toxicity, the spiritual, but also deals with certain components of the physiological response that the body needs, meaning that a down regulation, think of a car, again, with the engine, it's down regulating that idle. It's letting the engine rev at a lower speed. It helps to allow the physiology to become conducive to the healing, the innate healing abilities within the body. And what I mean by that is somebody may be listening to that and saying, well, what the heck does he mean by that? Well, if you're in a state of stress, your peripheral vascular system, your blood supply system, the vessels are constricted, and you're hypertensive. Your body's blood pressure is going up, and you're not in a mode that allows for perfusion, meaning the blood flow to go into the tissues and get, you know, work and do its job. Because remember, blood is taking nutrients to the cell and carrying waste products away from the cells. But if you're tensed up and you're tight, well, the blood vessel, think of that as a highway. The highway is narrower, so that it takes more effort of the heart to push the blood through that highway, through that vascular system that's constricted into the tissue in order for it to do its job. So now if you're meditating and you're relaxing, those highways open up, the vessels open up, there's vasodilation, the muscles are no longer constricted and constrained and contracted, they're relaxed and they're open, so the blood can perfuse through that tissue better and supply the nutrients better and pick up the waste product better and more efficiently. So when people say, well, you know, meditation has nothing to do with this, and I've heard many doctors give lip service to that mind-body connection, that meditation is crucial. It is crucial to help down-regulate the system and allow the system to start operating from a basis of actually doing what the system was designed to do as opposed to creating an issue, creating more barriers, creating more blocks to prevent the body from healing itself.
Now, when the patients are done with treatments at the clinic, do you have a follow-up process with them? Do they come back every few months? Are you on the phone with them? What do you usually do once they've left the clinic?
Well, the process of healing is a continuous process. So once we've got them to a certain point and the blood work shows and our assessments show that they're in control and cancer is no longer in control of the system, then we downgrade the frequency of the treatments that they're getting. And most of these treatments are all around the detoxification process and the immune enhancement process. But what's important to remember is that some of these toxicities took literally 10, 20, 30 years to accumulate. So there's an ongoing process. And so they'll go from the initial part, which is 5 days a week for so many weeks, depending on whether they've had chemo and radiation, and then it'll go down to 3 days a week, then it goes down to 2 days a week, then it goes to once every 2 weeks. And eventually we get to the point that they're coming once every 3 months to once every 6 months to once a year. And that's just usually for a follow-up. Their maintenance treatments they can do at other places. We have doctors that we've trained all over the world, and we've got doctors that have come through our training programs. Some of them that have come through our training programs, but we find the right doctor for them to continue maintaining their oil changes. Think of it as an oil change, a car. It's kind of like saying, well, I got an oil change once in my car, and then, 25,000 miles later, my engine blew. That's how people think of treating cancer. Well, it doesn't work that way. You need to do certain things to prevent the accumulation of those toxins. So removal of heavy metals, removal of persistent organic pollutants, that needs to be done on a regular, consistent basis. I'm 43 years old. I've never had cancer, thank God. I don't ever plan on having cancer, but I've been doing the same treatments in myself since the age of 32. For 11 years, I've been doing these treatments on myself as a preventive. So some of those components that we start off initially with the cancer to treat the patient that has that is suffering from cancer, those components of treatments will continue long after the cancer is no longer an issue. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, you bet. I mean, with all the doctors and clinicians that people will be going to throughout their treatments, certainly there's got to be some kind of rapport. What do you think are the most important qualities of an oncologist and other experts that cancer patients are seeking?
Well, that's a very powerful question. I've never been asked that before, and that's an excellent question. This is how I would answer that question. No matter who you're talking to, every one of us on this planet has what I call a BS meter, okay? That BS meter is very sensitive. Some of us tend to ignore it more than others, but we all have it. We all know what the truth is. It resonates with us, and we all know what something false is. And I would say that if you're going to talk to somebody as an expert, no matter what their credentials are, pay attention to that BS meter. And if that BS meter never fluctuates, not even an iota, it's just perfectly still, then you know that what you're hearing is the truth. But if it's all over the place and you have any sense that this doesn't make any, what the person's saying doesn't resonate with you, you need to go out and find a different person, to guide you, a different, doctor. And I really believe this because even when I have new patients coming to me, I tell them, whatever you choose is the right decision for you. If you never see me again, that is the right decision. Never question that. Whatever your heart tells you, listen to your heart. That's God speaking to us. That's a universal consciousness. That's what I believe. So I think that a person really needs to pay attention to how their response is to what they're hearing. And if it makes sense, if it resonates, if that the truth sinks to their heart, that's the person that you need to go with. And there's no better way that I could give you many different criteria. You may want to call this place and that. Or, I mean, that's all BS. It really comes down to, what do you feel? What feels right?
Yeah, absolutely. There is no perfect solution. There is no perfect treatment. There's only the right treatment for you. And everybody is different. And when you know in your gut, when you know that there's a factor of trust, when there's a factor of care, then you know that you're at the right place you should be at.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, too. One of the things for me as a physician, and I think this is a concern that has become very prominent in my mind a number of years ago, you have to understand that when a patient comes to a doctor, there's certain obligations that a doctor has, a fiduciary relationship to the patient. And unfortunately, that's where, the medical ethics program comes in and with the informed consent aspect. Now, I think the entire medical profession has lost their gourd because they're talking about informed consent and how important that is from an ethics consideration, yet they don't tell patients that they need to get the detoxification. They don't talk about heavy metal toxicity. They don't talk about persistent organic pollutants. And yet they think that, you know, by telling a person that, yeah, you've got this option, this option, this option, the three different types of surgical options, the two types of medical therapeutics option, but they don't talk about all the detoxification, they've failed in that informed consent, first of all. So I wanted to kind of throw that out there because that's a terrible, terrible thing that we as a medical profession have done. But when a patient comes and the patient hasn't made the decision yet, they're coming to me for a second opinion, I don't want to tell that patient that, look, this is the only answer, because if the patient doesn't go through my treatment, now, let's just use heart disease as an example, and I say, look, you need to do heavy metal detoxification, you need to get chelation therapy, and the patient says, decides that they don't want to go through that route and they're going to go through the bypass. Right before the anesthesiologist induces them and puts them to sleep, before the cardiovascular surgeon opens up their chest and does their work on their heart, what do you think the last thing that person is going to be conscious of before the anesthesiologist puts them to sleep? If I, as a doctor, told the patient that you need to get chelation, the patient chooses to go to get the bypass, the last thing he's going to think before the anesthesiologist puts him to sleep is that other doctor told me I should get chelation. Maybe that was the right choice. And I never want to put that doubt in a person's mind. So I never tell a patient what to do. I tell them, I give them all the different questions. I answer all the questions that they have when they come to me. Now, once the patient has told me that this is what I want, and I make it tough on a patient to make sure before they decide, because I want them to really be sure. They're coming to me to, you know, I'm the general that's going to lead this battle. They're coming to me saying they've got a battle and they want me to win the fight. Well, I need to make sure, is that army that I'm going to lead into battle, one, willing to do what is going to be necessary to win? Because I don't want to go into a losing battle. So once the patient's convinced me that they're the right patient and they feel that I'm the right general for them to lead them into this battle, then I will tell them what they should do. And I'm very adamant and I'll help them because they have now decided that this is the route they want to go. But until a patient's made that decision, I can't, ethically I can't, and I don't mean medical ethics, I mean just looking at myself in the mirror ethics, can't tell them to do this treatment versus that treatment because they haven't made that decision. And I don't want to have that burden that in their mind they may think, well, maybe that doctor, the choice that I didn't make, maybe that was the right choice. And this goes back to what you just said, that every person, every treatment, whatever a person chooses to do, it's the right treatment for them. And it's important for them to realize that. And I don't want to be the one who's guiding them into one making the wrong decision, the right decision. Because for that person, maybe they'll have the bypass and then have another problem. Generally speaking, that's not the case. But the point is, that could be the right answer for them. So it's very important for a patient to realize that the number one person that's responsible for your health is you, and you have to be proactive in doing the right things in order to get yourself and keep yourself healthy. And no matter how good the doctor is, it's not the doctor's responsibility. Now, I tell patients that if what are you willing to put forward to get better? And if a patient says 70% and the doctor responds with, hey, okay, I'll give you 70%, the patient's not going to want that. My patient goes, no, wait a second, I want 100%. Well, you have to give 100% first. But if you give 100%, your doctor will give you 100%. And if you as a patient, if you give 100% and your mindset is right and you make whatever decision that you have made, once you've made that decision, and you're sure that that's the way that you want to go with, that is the right decision, and go forward. Don't hesitate. Don't hem and haw. It's like passing an 18-wheeler. You don't hesitate once you start passing it. Once you make the decision to pass, you push on the accelerator, and you go all the way. That's the thing that I think that people need to remember, that with cancer, you're dealing with that type of a situation. You're passing an 18-wheeler, and you need to make your decision and then be committed to that decision and go full forward. Always listen to your heart, because that is the guide that gives you the truth versus guiding you on the right path versus keeping you on the wrong path.
Absolutely. You made a couple great analogies there. I like when you were talking about going into battle. I mean, you've got, the Army, the Navy, you've got all the armed forces, overseas right now, and they're making decisions. You know, they've got someone leading them. And if you don't, the last thing you want is mutiny amongst your own patients, where you're trying to lead them to victory and they're not sure which direction to turn. They have to be ready when they get to you, and they have to be willing to act and not react. Too many people react. Very few people know how to act and take full control over their own treatments. Do you agree?
Absolutely, without a doubt. In fact, it's not just in dealing with disease. It's in everything in life. We look at success versus failure in every component of life, whether it's personal, financial, families, spiritual, social circles, comes to your health, comes to everything. Very, very few people are proactive. Most people, as you said, are reactive. And that's the problem. When you're in a reactive mode, you're not making any progress. I couldn't agree with what you said more.
I tell you, one philosophy I've always had in my life is never, ever worry about something for longer than it actually takes to do it.
Yeah, isn't that true?
And that's the problem, is that here it is. You know, a lot of people are afraid of needles when they need to go to the doctor and get a shot, where the shot could have been over in 5 seconds, and they put themselves in this psychological mess, fearing the doctor or fearing going to the dentist. That's another thing that a lot of people are afraid of.
You have no idea how important what you've just said is to the overall picture of people getting better, because that is the essence of pathology, I believe, in our society today. It is that we throw ourselves into a conundrum when there is no need to be in the conundrum. And it comes down to, as you said, you know, we live either we're worrying about what's going to happen in the future, or we're worrying about what happened in the past, but we need to remember to live in the now. And when you live in the now, something remarkable happens. In fact, I'm going to quote two of my favorite quotes. They come from very high levels of wisdom. One is from Spider-Man, and one is from Kung Fu Panda. So you can tell I have some younger kids. So I have a 4-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 16-year-old. So the best movies that I've seen, and I don't know whether you've ever watched Kung Fu Panda or Spider-Man, but let me give you this quote from Kung Fu Panda. And this brings the essence of what we're discussing here, this last part that we're just discussing here, brings it to the forefront. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why we call it the present.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And I have seen the movie, and it's still amazing to hear that. And it's a perfectly elegant way to come to the end of our interview here. We've got just a few moments left, and I want to ask you, you had a couple free videos, 4 free videos, where you educate people on toxins and chronic diseases. Where can people see that for their very own eyes?
Well, actually, it's 9 videos that are free. They're about 20 minutes long each, correct? And the site is going to be up and ready to go August the 15th and of this year, just in another 2 weeks. And you can actually go and watch the first 3 videos now if you'd like. But it's factsontoxicity.com. And the goal behind this project was to create something that can rapidly be disseminated throughout the world so that people are empowered with knowledge. It actually comes, brings me up to the second quote from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And I believe that as we become empowered and as we learn the truth, we have a responsibility to pass that information on to those that we care about, to those that we love, to those that we value. And the videos we created to explain these 7 toxicities and their relationship to chronic disease, and all in completely for free, there's no charge for this at all, our only request is that if people find them to be of value, that they take the time to refer their friends and family and loved ones to the site. And the first 3 videos people will find everywhere, but then to continue watching past the first 3 videos, the rest of them are on that site itself, Facts and Toxicity. And pretty much, you know, the first 3 videos people go through and they're just blown away because they start seeing the truth and they understand what this is all about. And that's where they get it from. There's no cost to them, and it's all online.
Fantastic. And what was that URL one more time?
Facts on Toxicity, FACTS. On Toxicity, TOXICITY.
Well, Dr. Buttar, first of all, I got to tell you, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I want to ask you, did you have any final thoughts, words of hope, and encouragement that you could give to our listeners?
Well, I want you to all remember that, at least from my perspective, the first patient that I lost when I went to private practice, and when I said lost, that died, was a lady that had breast cancer, and she was told that she would never see Thanksgiving again. She was in hospice, and she was referred to hospice. And when she came to us, it was sometime in August, I believe. This was in 1997, and she was told that she would never see Thanksgiving again. And I told her, "What do you want?" And she said, "I want to see Thanksgiving." And I said, "That's all you want to see, Thanksgiving?" And she said, "Well, I will be happy if I see Thanksgiving." So I said, "All right, then that's our goal. If that's what your goal is, that's what our goal is." Well, Thanksgiving came and went, and she did, you know, very well. And she was now at a point that she felt even better. And she said, you know, "I know I'm going to be here till Easter." And we went through Christmas, went through Easter. Everything she wanted to do, we went. And she was doing better and better. She went on a vacation in Mexico in May of that following year, and she came back from Mexico and she got a cough. And from the time that she developed this cough to the time she got in the hospital and she was put on a respirator and then she passed on, she died, was about 48 hours. And I got to the hospital when she was in a respirator, and she looked at me with this look of panic because she couldn't breathe. And I was holding her hand, and I told her, it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. And she completely relaxed, and she had the only sentiment I can express is that she had love in her eyes. And when I told her everything's going to be okay, she gave me this look like everything's going to be okay, like she knew everything's going to be okay, and she relaxed. And I guess maybe 8 hours later, she died. When I found out she died, it was early in the morning. I came back to the hospital, and I saw her husband in the hallway. And he approached me, and he hugged me. And, I hugged him back. And I remember saying to him, I was sorry. And I just felt like such a failure. And I must have said I was sorry three times. And he kind of pulled himself away from me, and he looked at me, and like a quizzical look. And he said, what the hell are you talking about? You're sorry. And I said, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to save her. And he said, you gave her 9 more months of life that nobody else even thought that she could have. But more importantly than that, those were the best 9 months of my life with my wife. He goes, we traveled, we enjoyed, she was able to love and laugh. And he said, don't you ever say you're sorry to me again. Up to that point in my life, I used to think that life was success and death was failure. And then I realized after what this man said to me, that and it was a personal point of growth for me, where I realized that what I had been thinking of success and failure wasn't really what success and failure is about. So the question is, when we're alive and we're talking about cancer, many of us go through our life not even realizing what life is about. I would have, and this is one of the things that this man said to me, he said, I would rather have 9 months of my life with my wife like I've just had than have an eternity with her like we had before. Because in the last 9 months, we really lived. So I would want people to remember that live your life like you only have 1 day left, or 1 week left, or 1 month left. And when you live your life like that, then whenever the time comes for us to pass on to the next realm, because everybody dies, you know. I got a great comment from a dentist that sent me this email. He said, don't take life too seriously. Nobody gets out alive. So we're all going to die. The question is, have we lived while we're here? And I would like to point out to the people that may be listening to this that when you hear about cancer, we get this impression that we've got this death sentence. It is not a death sentence. Maybe it's an awakening. Maybe it's an alert. Maybe God is tapping you in the shoulder and said, get up, wake up, open your eyes, and live your life. Because many patients that have gone through our treatment that are today doing very well, they've told me that it's transformed their life completely. It has given them an appreciation for life, and they are now truly living their life. And some of them have said that they don't even really remember what their purpose was before, but now they know what their purpose is. So I would encourage you to live your life, those that are listening, to live your life the way you would live it were you to be given some type of a end, you know, like that you've got only a month left or something. And you'll find that when you live your life like that, live in the moment, live now, because today we have, tomorrow we don't know what's going to happen. And that's what life is about. That's what I believe that the Creator wants. And if we do everything to always do the right by what feels in our heart, you can't go wrong. Cancer is only a symptom. Cancer is only a symptom of a toxic system that doesn't have the nutrient base that it needs. When a tree dies, the last thing it does before it dies, it goes into a rapid state of pollination. It spreads its seed everywhere. It's the last thing it does before it dies. Now, I believe that when somebody gets cancer, at that point, wherever it starts, I believe that the cells are so toxic, and there's so much of a depletion of the nutrients that are necessary to keep that area, that cell or those cells functional, that it's about to die, but it's not natural for that area to just shut down. So what it does is it goes into a rapid survival phase. And just as a tree rapidly proliferates, spreads its seed, that's what happens in that area. Well, rapid uncontrolled cellular proliferation, meaning the spreading of cells, that is the same thing as a tree, and that is the definition of cancer, uncontrolled cellular proliferation. If your body at a certain point is proliferating to that point of rapid growth, all it's trying to do is survive. That's a symptom, and we think that this is some bad, heinous, you know, monster that comes into our body spontaneously. No, it doesn't. I believe that it is in response to toxicity and the inability of the system to keep up with the nutrient demands and not getting enough nutrients. So if you provide the body with the right balance, that should negate. Now, of course, we do certain things to go after the cancer, but that's actually a secondary mode. Our first mode is to detoxify and to improve the immune system and to give the body the nutrients that it needs. And then whatever is left over that doesn't stop and doesn't go back to its normal state, then we'll try to go after that. But I used to go after cancer directly. I don't even do that anymore. I actually have taken on this other philosophy, and it's working even better because many times the tumor breakdown from what we were breaking down was so rapid the person couldn't deal with it. So I didn't mention that, and I kind of wanted to kind of finish that, you know, bring that story full circle home, that when you're dealing with cancer and we have this impression that we get that we're told by the doctors and it's doom and gloom, remember, it's just a symptom. It's a wake-up call. Live your life the right way, and the cancer, many people have beaten it, and many people will continue to beat it. And this is where you go into the spontaneous healing. When you ask doctors, you know, how did this person get better? You gave them 6 months to live, and they're, you know, mountain climbing and doing this, all this stuff, and they're like, well, it's a miracle. We don't know how. Well, it wasn't from the chemo. It wasn't from the radiation, because they never got the chemo or the radiation. And they may not have even gotten the type of treatments we do. They just got better. Well, what was the shift? We don't know. The last unknown is not outer space. It's within the body. We are incredible beings capable of incredible things. And if the perfect piece of machinery is the human body, if we were a car and we put in the kind of crap we put into our system and we were a car, we'd only run for 2 weeks. So remember that. Take care of your body. Do the right thing, and everything else will fall into place.
Absolutely. Wonderfully said. Focus on the quality of life, not so much the quantity of how much time you have left, but the quality of what you're going through right now. Absolutely right about that.
And the strange thing is when you emphasize that the quality aspect, the quantity will by itself increase. There's a great story about an industrialist that lived in the turn of the century, and I can't remember the name of it, but the story is told in a great book called Beating Cancer and Nutrition by a friend of mine, Dr. Patrick Quillen. And he talks about this guy that was told he had just a few months left to live because he had tuberculosis. And he was, since he knew he was going to die, he decided that he was going to go and live out in the West because he loved the West and he was, you know, he loved nature. And he thought, well, I'm going to go and spend the last couple of years of my life out in the Yellowstone. And I believe he was out in Yellowstone somewhere. And so he went there, and the first thing he did was he carved his own gravestone because he didn't know whether he would be around whether there'd be anybody around to bury him, since he was out there in the middle of nowhere by himself. So he carved his own gravestone. So he came to terms with the end of his own life. And then he had to survive, so he had to, you know, for the couple more months that he had, so he started hunting and gathering berries and, you know, just living off the land. Well, that couple months turned into, you know, 6 months, and the 6 months turned into a year, and the year turned into 2 years, and 2 years turned into five, and five turned into 10, and 10 turned into 20. He ended up living out there for another 40 years with this terminal condition. So you never know what happens, because when you focus in on that, as you said, quality of life, and you start living life the right way, a strange thing happens with the quantity. It just comes.
I got to tell you, Dr. Buttar, you've been fantastic. I mean, you've been a wealth of information, a true source of expertise. You've absolutely over-delivered during this interview, and I just sincerely want to thank you for spending some time today with me and my listeners.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to do so.
My pleasure. We've been speaking with Dr. Rashid Buttar from North Carolina, and he's been giving us a candid look at his own story of survival with his patients. Now, this is Dave Bernstein. I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and we'll talk to you soon.